Good morning. Here is the latest news from abroad, as reported by National Broadcasting Company correspondents in foreign capitals. To hear the latest news in England, we take you now to London.
This is John McVane in London. This morning, British heavy bombers, escorted by fighters, made another sweep over northern France to carry out what is described as the successful bombardment of a synthetic oil plant between Lens and Béthune. 7 German fighters were destroyed. 5 British fighters and 1 bomber are missing, but 2 British pilots are safe. Last night, British bombers made heavy attacks on Cologne, Osnabrück, Münster, Frankfurt, and other points in western Germany. Southampton last night had one of its sharpest attacks of the war. Practically no district escaped damage. Casualties are believed to have been light, but at least a dozen people are known to have been killed and others are missing. 5 German planes were shot down. It was announced today that a Soviet Army, Navy, and Air Force mission has arrived in London and has already been in close contact with the British service ministries. The mission is headed by Major General Golikov and includes Rear Admiral Kalanov. It was stated in London today that a certain number of British troops are remaining in Iceland for the present, but they will be withdrawn as the situation dictates. The British troops will be under the command of the American Army Commander. The British Navy will continue to use Iceland as a base when necessary, and will be under the command of the American Admiral on the spot. In the opinion of British commentators, America's occupation of Iceland has put Hitler in a difficult position. These commentators believe that America's decision may have swift and far-reaching consequences. It's explained here that Germany's attack on Russia was calculated to divide American opinion with the old Bolshevik bogey. If the plan had been successful, British observers say, Hitler could, after conquering Russia, have returned to seize Britain, Iceland, and Dakar as basis for an attack on the United States. Now they think President Roosevelt's announcement has proved that America has not been tricked by Hitler's latest maneuver. One paper headlines its editorial with the words, "The Eagle has wings." The editorial points out that many of the great convoys bearing food and arms to Britain pass close to Iceland, and that for 2/3 of the way across the Atlantic, they will now sail under the vigilance of American warships. The late edition of this morning's Daily Express starts off its editorial with the words, "The Atlantic Ocean last night became an Anglo-American lake." The Daily Express says that from Iceland to Trinidad and British Guiana, American forces are now disposed to prevent a pincer movement in the Western Hemisphere, and notes significantly that the 15th degree of longitude that runs through the easternmost point of Iceland also takes in the Cape Verde Islands and Dakar. The London Daily Mail calls the president's action a startling and courageous precedent in the history of the United States. In Britain, we can breathe more freely, the Mail continues. There are other Atlantic islands equally dangerous to America, the Azores and the Cape Verde Islands. There is also Dakar. We may rest assured that Hitler will think hard before stretching a greedy claw towards any one of these. America has passed the stage of threat. I've just been a couple of weeks in the Highlands of Scotland. The village in which I stayed was an old one, beside a lake, sheltered in the sweep of green mountains. A fishing guide, or gilly as they are called, showed me beneath the lake's surface ruins of crannogs, or lake dwellings, where thousands of years before Julius Caesar came to Britain, men built their homes on water as protection from wild beasts. It's a peaceful village now. Only once or twice, high overhead, have been heard the sounds of hostile planes flying to bomb the Clyde Bank in Glasgow. But the village is organized for its own defense. 24 hours a day, home guards are on watch at observation posts. The minister is an air raid warden. The postmaster is another. And are ready if incendiary should fall. Every householder in that remote and peaceful place has had written instructions as to what to do if the bombs ever do fall. The village hasn't always been peaceful. There are tales of old Highland clan warfare in the country around about that make modern warfare in comparison seem less violent. But now hotels and boarding houses are crowded with old people who have enough income to come there in search of rest and quiet. In the local public house, the Highland men listen to Polish soldiers talking their swift, incomprehensible tongue. The Poles are well-liked by the villagers, who regard them as very polite and well-behaved. You often saw Poles treating villagers to beer, or the villagers returning the compliment, when about the only word they had in common was cheerio and a smile. The Highlanders I talked with, from guides to hotel keepers, seem to have a ready grasp of international affairs. But the old retired people who have come there from the cities seem far more remote from everyday affairs. They were all discussing the prophecies of some group that believes the British are one of the lost tribes of Israel, The evacuees said the prophecies of this group derived from the Bible have proved remarkably accurate. I gather that they identified Hitler with the beast mentioned in the Book of Revelations and predicted Hitler and Stalin would destroy each other in very short order. Someone who mentioned that during the last war, the Kaiser was definitely identified as the beast of Revelations was regarded as a light-minded scoffer at truth. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
And that is the news in London this morning, as given by John McVane. And now abroad once more, this time for news from Germany. Go ahead, Berlin.
Hello, NBC. This is Charles Yonius in Berlin. German officials on the Wilhelmstrasse today had no comment to make on the report that American troops had landed in Iceland. When asked what the German reaction to the story was, an official replied that he had nothing to say at the present, but intimated that he might be in a position to do so later in the day. On the 17th day of the German offensive against Russia, reports now revealed that the Germans have gotten down to the business of smashing the Stalin line. The Germans say that they penetrated the lines at several points yesterday, in spite of the tough resistance put up by the Reds. The Germans called the Stalin line the last coherent, fortified red line of resistance in the European part of the Soviet Union. The message here this morning indicates the Germans have already knocked over the advanced forts and bunkers at some points of the line. One report tells how in one section, German storm troops took 20 modernly equipped bunkers after what is described as fierce and violent fighting. The Germans announced that in this same sector, they captured 154 Soviet tanks and 100 guns of heavy and medium caliber. Another report says that assault units took a strong fort, which is mentioned as part of the Stalin line, after several hours of fighting in the subterranean passages. The Russian affairs locked the defenders in the garrison and forced them to sacrifice their lives. There were only 20 survivors, 8 of them reported to be women. On the northern front, the Germans announced they had broken through Russian toolbox defense lines after a 15-hour battle with picked Asiatic troops. Some of the pill boxes were so cleverly concealed that they were almost invisible, and the Germans say that they were only taken after fierce hand-to-hand fighting. In the middle front, the Russians, defeated in battles between the Berezkin and Prepid rivers, are said to be making desperate efforts to get back to the Stalin line. The Germans state that only a small percentage of these troops can reach their rear defenses because the Germans are coming in too fast for them to organize a retreat. At the same time, according to the Germans, the Luftwaffe is continually battling the Soviet lines of Mark and Stuttgart. The impression here is that the situation is this constant has hopeful. Today, the German state protects all of the territory which Russia grabbed after the war started in 1939 has been taken by the Germans and their Balkan allies. German and Hungarian troops have passed the captured town of Cernovich in the south, and the German states the Russians are retreating in Galicia along a broad front. German figures released today show that between the 2nd and 5th of July, their advance columns took a total of 142,216 prisoners, 594 tanks, and 550 pieces of modern artillery. Early this morning, a British squadron of 4 mortar bombers, accompanied by pursuit planes, flew across the channel to attack Calais. The Germans report that one of the big 4 mortar jobs and all the fighter machines were shut down. In attacks on Western and Northwestern Germany last night, the Royal Air Force lost 6 planes, according to the Germans. The British bombs, they say, caused only slight damage and casualties among the civilian population. The Germans bombarded Southampton last night. They say that direct hits were scored on the gas works and harbor installations. Other German bombers are said to have attacked a convoy in the Thames estuary. Today, the Germans announced the bombing of the city and canal of Suez yesterday morning. The full moon ended the attack, and the Germans say the attack was successful in spite of strong anti-aircraft fire from British ground batteries. This is Charles Lanius in Berlin. I now return you to NBC in New York.
And that's the latest news of the war. To get the latest reports on happenings in our own nation, here is Earl Godwin speaking from the NBC newsroom in Washington.
Good morning, folks. Naturally, Washington wakes up still talking about the president's crackling message to Congress. We have sent naval forces, blue jackets and marines, to Iceland, and we have occupied bases in the Caribbean Sea. We divide here along classic lines, the classic lines, traditional lines. The senators and representatives acclaim or oppose, in conformity with their well-known, now fairly well crystallized views, for and against the government's foreign policies, and the feeling is getting bitter and bitter. Most, and typically most succinct statements, come from House Leader McCormick, who says that if the Nazis occupied Iceland, they would be in position to stop 80% of the British shipping to England. On the other hand, Senator John Danaher of Connecticut says the Iceland move brings us 1,000 miles nearer to a shooting war. Senator Wheeler of Montana, whom you recognize as the leader of the isolationists and who predicted this Iceland move the other day, wants to know when we will occupy the Cape Verde Islands and the outjutting African point known as Dakar and the Azores. The president's supporters take the move as a necessary defensive move, based on presumably authentic knowledge that the Germans plan to occupy Iceland, which this government would view as a hostile and dangerous threat toward this Western Hemisphere, that would be a violation of the Monroe Doctrine, which has been restated time and time again, and which Congress itself has endorsed and revived by 2 votes in the past few months. Incidentally, of course, to many people geographically, it's a long stretch to include Iceland in the provisions of the Monroe Doctrine, and senators are already arguing whether or not that island is within or without the Western Hemisphere. I merely report it to you. From a defense standpoint, experts say that if the Nazis intended to step into Iceland and then into Greenland, which is clearly within the Western Hemisphere, they would be but an afternoon's plane ride to the state of Maine. That's the viewpoint of the administration. What the Germans have to say about it, you heard this morning a few minutes ago from Charles Lanius in Berlin. If what they will say so far is problematical, but Washington expects a blast of ill-concealed hostility. But you never can tell. In the absence of anything from Germany, here's an idea. Some of our officials believe that the Germans are less likely to attack an American force in and about Iceland than the British, because the Germans are at war with the British, not the United States of America, and the Germans are not anxious to bring this country formally into the war. But you may recall that not so long ago, the president said the next Bunker Hill might be 2,000 miles from Boston. Today, the House starts debate on the bill to defer draftees at age 28. I think it's a foregone conclusion that bill will inevitably be passed. Both houses have already acted on it, but there are differences between the two bills. It's a foregone conclusion that the bill will be passed and the president will sign it. However, the bill also carries anti-strike provisions, which are poison to labor. The House is ready to debate this thing rather reluctantly. CIO leaders have been encamped here in Washington for 3 days, bearing down heavily on Congress to defeat the Connally-May bill, which empowers the president to take over struck plants in defense industries, and which makes strikes illegal under certain circumstances and makes strikers and some picketers criminal under certain conditions, and labor leaders simply will not stand for it. They may be defeated, but they're going down fighting. Meantime, Congress has not yet received any formal recommendations covering General Marshall's recent suggestions that there should be more time for the citizen soldiers who have been selected to go to camp, and that there should be no limits on where the Army can serve in any hemisphere. Incidentally, General Marshall is receiving letters from the general public which indicate many people believe they think this is Marshall's personal army. They seem to forget that the Army's size and makeup and its general policy, where it goes and so forth, are all in the hands of Congress and the President. And that's all the news from Washington at this time.
And that's the up-to-the-minute news of the world. This morning, you have heard NBC reporters in London, Berlin, and Washington. This is the National Broadcasting Company. Replacing the announced program, NBC takes you now to Reykjavik, Iceland.
Today added the Republic of Iceland to the long list of stations where they have had occasion to plant Old Glory in foreign lands. At the same time, they added another chapter to the famous sagas of this island, which are known throughout the Western world for their description of the picturesque struggle of Viking days. American Marines are the traditional expeditionary force, and they have been to most of the countries in the world. But few of those who are here today would have guessed 3 weeks ago where they were going to find themselves in 3 weeks' time. Yesterday afternoon, the whole island, Icelanders and the British garrison as well, was stirred by the news which flashed from mouth to mouth that a huge convoy was approaching, steaming majestically across the calm grey sea. Groups of soldiers and crowds of Icelanders gathered together on the vantage point to watch this inspiring sight. Although the early stages of the journey had not been so lucky with the weather, it certainly was kind when the convoy arrived, and to many, their first sight of Iceland must have been a surprise. No ice, but instead a land of towering, massive mountains, their tops hidden in mist, and at their feet, bright emerald green fields dotted with sheep. Little groups of whitewashed farmhouses with a toy-like church to each group. Soon after 6 o'clock, the first ships dropped their anchors in the harbour, and the adventure began. Representatives of the British forces went aboard the American ships shortly afterwards, and the foundations of lasting friendships were laid. Not many Americans came ashore last night, but a surprise was there just the same. For in Iceland, at this time of the year, the daylight never goes, and it's very nearly as light at midnight as it is at midday. This morning, a few minutes before 10 o'clock, things started moving. The commander of the British troops, accompanied by members of his staff and representatives of other services, waited at the pier to greet some of the first American soldiers to set foot on Icelandic soil. A launch flying the American flag was already in sight, and exactly on time drew alongside. The American general stepped ashore, followed by some of his staff. There were handshakes all round, and then as they turned to walk up the pier, a sharp word of command brought the guard of honour, provided by a local battalion and commanded by a kilted officer, to the general salute. The inspection of the guard of honour was followed by a march past, and it was an impressive scene as the guard, with their band, passed the two commanders. It made an onlooker realise that forces had been released which will make Hitler wake up from his wild dreams of conquest, and that he would soon bitterly regret the day when he loosed the horror of Armageddon on a world which believed that such a tragedy was impossible. After the ceremony came business, and soon British staff officers, having found and met the numbers from across the Atlantic, were telling them all they could and making them very welcome to Iceland. A fleet of cars was ready to take them to headquarters for their first conference, and in a few minutes the pier was deserted. No sooner had the cars left than the real business of unloading and disembarking began. Launches full of officers and men left the big ship and sped towards the shore. One big merchantman was already alongside and busy discharging its cargo. Members of the British garrison admired the magnificent equipment which was put ashore in vast quantities. By midday, nearly every group of soldiers contained an almost equal number of British and Americans, and there's no doubt that the representatives of what the British general recently described as Great Britain's best friend were being given a very hearty welcome. All morning the work went on, and only a fraction of the vast store of goods could be put on Icelandic soil. It must be many days before the great ships are finally emptied. Meanwhile, at headquarters, the American commander and his staff had luncheon at the British mess. The huts to which the British garrison had become so accustomed may have seemed strange to the Americans, but the cook had done his best, and the commander gave orders to his staff to find out where some of our delicacies, all of local origin, could be obtained. It was a meal which was enjoyed by both sides, and there was no break in the talk and laughter which accompanied it. After luncheon, cars were waiting to take the general and his staff to their camp. These, which have withstood one Icelandic winter, were more comfortable than some had supposed, and there's no doubt they will provide a home for the Marines, which will compare quite favourably with many of the places in which they have found themselves in the past. British troops in the neighborhood quickly made friends with the newcomers, and won't be long before the whole garrison are as one. All afternoon, the work of unloading went on, and by this evening, American transport was to be seen on the Icelandic roads, some of which are rather difficult to negotiate at any speed. The left-hand rule of the road, which is enforced here, may cause drivers some difficulty at first, but no doubt they'll soon get used to it. Tomorrow, the commander and his senior staff officers are paying the usual compliments to the regent, the prime minister, and other members of the government. Tomorrow also, the work of unloading, unpacking, and settling down will continue. Now, before I stop, I'll tell you a few things about Iceland. Iceland is a land of contrast. The majestic, bare mountains contrast sharply with the green fields in summer. The warm, sunny days with cloudless skies, which we're sometimes lucky enough to have in summer, contrast with the blizzards of winter. The wild, rugged fastnesses of the interior contrast with the modernity of the towns. Ubiquitous electric lights, a fine telephone system, many cars, and a well-equipped radio station seem odd when compared to the simplicity of the farmhouses to be found in some parts of the country. Iceland is the oldest democracy, and the Althing the oldest parliament. One of the most interesting features of Iceland is the bird life in summer. Although there are only a very few birds which live in Iceland all the year round, vast numbers of migrants come here in the summer to nest. And as nearly all are protected by law, they have become remarkably tame, and they show an indifference to the presence of man, which makes them a very attractive part of Iceland. For the rest, the rivers teem with salmon and trout, and the seas with cod and other fish. In the peacetime, which will surely soon come again, deep sea fishing will again take its place as one of Iceland's major industries. Well, in this short time, I haven't been able to tell you much, but I hope it's been enough to give you some sort of picture of the arrival of the American troops in Iceland. And before I stop, may I, as a British officer, assure you that the welcome we have today extended to your soldiers is sincere and grateful, and that so long as we are here, everything will be done to ensure that the memories the Marines will carry back with them of their stay in Iceland will be happy ones. Good night.
Ladies and gentlemen, yesterday, President Roosevelt, in a message to Congress, announced the occupation of Iceland by United States naval forces. Tonight, the National Broadcasting Company has brought you the first direct report from the scene by an American broadcaster. This program was heard in the United States through facilities of RCA Communications. We now bring you a late bulletin from the NBC newsroom, Berlin. The mouthpiece of the German Foreign Office, DNB, today viewed the United States entry into Iceland as a stab in the back of a European community, which it said was struggling with Bolshevism for preservation of Western civilization. Its comment was the first from competent German quarters on the Iceland situation. This broadcast, which you have just heard from Iceland, was the first broadcast which anyone has heard from Iceland since the start of the present conflict. And here is another bulletin from our NBC newsroom. Moscow. The Red Army, in a counterattack against German and Romanian troops in the Bessarabian sector of the front, has thrown the invaders back in disorder across the Prut River. This information came from the Soviet Information Bureau today. This is the Blue Network of the National Broadcasting Company.